Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. This is Karen Karp. I am filling in for Mitchell Davis, who is away this week, and it is my great pleasure to be guest hosting this show, as I do from time to time, and to welcome my guest this morning, Monica Gelinas, who is the principal and founder of a very interesting food consulting business called Gritwork. We are going to speak today about the evolution of taste when it comes to quick serve and retail food development, manufacturing, distribution, and experience. Monica, welcome. Please tell us a little bit about who you are and what you're up to.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. And I just also want to wish everybody a happy Chinese New Year, Year of the Horse, last week.
Yes.
And before I started Gritwork about 2 years ago, Karen and I have had a long relationship for almost 20 years working to bring good food to the city. So it's exciting to be on the show. For my work now today, it really focuses on bridging this gap around sustainable supply chain and product development. And when we talk about those words, it's sort of very lofty. It's around really coming together in the sweet spot around sort of putting food, fresh food out to the consumers, but on the back end to really support supply chain issues, R&D, sales, and the operations, so the heart of the business. So a lot of the work that I do across, whether it's for a distributor or for a brand, like a retail brand, or for a fast casual concept, is really playing that linchpin to connect the dots together. Great. And putting sustainability, really operationalizing it.
Great. Let's put a little sort of flesh on the bones around this whole concept, because it might be a little bit esoteric to some of our readers, our listeners. And by the way, to our listeners, if you'd like to call in with a question for either Monica or myself, or tweet or email a question, I will give you all the details right now. Calling 718-417-1118. info@heritageradionetwork.org, or you could tweet questions to @TasteMattersHRN. So let's kind of make this a little bit alive for people. One of the projects that we worked on together, which I really consider the cornerstone of the career you have now, is when we helped Pret A Manger establish their operations in the United States. And I'm trying to remember what year that was, and I think it was 2000, 2001.
It was actually November of 1999.
Oh my goodness.
So, right. And you have to remember the landscape at that time here in New York. There wasn't Whole Foods, there wasn't Trader Joe's, there wasn't this proliferation of Chipotle's on every single block. So we really rode on the coattails of bringing sort of natural, quote unquote, food to the masses.
Right. What did Pret mean in England? What was the kind of consumer identification with the brand Pret in England at the time? I have my memory, you have your memory.
I mean, my takeaway then and now looking back might be a little different, but it was really about fast. So being served, you know, in the dairy cases, grab and go, whether it's a minute or less, and sort of honing in on sort of this element around natural. So I remember they had that A to Z guide. The Bible around our food ingredients and sort of the nasties and no's around whether it was additives, preservatives, and chemicals.
Right.
And that sort of dove deeper into asking the question, well, where does our food come from? from, and how does that really play out in flavors in the sandwiches?
Right. I mean, I was living in London at the time, and that's actually how that's where I met one of the owners of Pret, and you were living here, and we did this project kind of cross the ocean, which was really kind of exciting at the time, in 1999, oh my goodness. And I remember that Bible. I remember we walked into their office, in that office behind Victoria Station, and it was kind of a crappy office, right? It was like desks and stuff everywhere, and piles of paper, and lots of people kind of, you know, all sort of disjointed, distracted, and working very hard, like very purposely for, like, you know, the purpose of good food, right? And then, was it Nurit? She walked out of an office, and she literally was carrying what looked like the Gutenberg Bible. I mean, this thing was like 10 bricks stacked on top of one another. And as I recall, tell me if you remember this the same way, I recall she basically said, your job is to replicate this in the United States.
Yes, and I remember getting those big files and saying, okay, well, now you have to find all new local vendors for zero stores in New York and, you know, ask manufacturers to make the same, what's called a specification. So make our exact same recipe as we do in England with these no's, right? No chemicals, additives, preservatives, and with very little volume, which is always the big question, right? How much are you going to buy? And can we do this for you at the price that you want to pay for?
So there were multiple issues. One of the issues was just the specifications and very, very detailed specifications. And they were fairly adamant about replicate this 100%. The second, your point about they were going to have one shop. So how do you talk to vendors, suppliers, local or not local, about doing a very unique specification just for one shop that might have who knows how much business because it was an unknown brand in the United States, right? Yeah. And then there was the, as I recall, the sort of very basic issue of are people going to want to eat this food?
Right. And it was the thought around, and I think this is where culture plays in, right? Where, you know, in England, they eat a lot of sandwiches potentially with mayonnaise. And here we thought, oh gosh, mayonnaise, maybe that talks about high fat, and all these questions came on. Or do people want prepackaged food, prepared packaged food, cold sandwich on a wintry day like today was a big question mark as well in that translation.
So there was the menu problem on top of the specification problem.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you remember, I know people in New York appreciate this, is that they eat smoked salmon with butter.
Right.
And yeah, I know. I know.
Mitchell is probably curling in his
head. That doesn't happen. You never want to know a smoked salmon. Of course, it's with cream cheese, you know? So there was sort of these comments around sort of what's called menu development and how we were going to translate certain sort of cultural.
Right. So that's a good bridge into this whole sort of cultural notion of what we, not me, but our culture and our country, what we're doing to try to kind of create better tasting food, brighter, lighter, healthier, fresher, natural, more sustainable, more organic, whatever, food at scale. And that project really was one of the first ones because they were trying to do many, many, many different things. And one of the things that they did, which may not be so unusual now, and you'll tell us that it's not because you know that it's not, is they decided to hire a chef and have a head chef. And of course, all manufacturing places have head chefs, R&D chefs, etc. But they wanted a very particular kind of chef. And so I want to talk a little bit about the culture of chefs and where and how chefs are used in this kind of quick serve, fast casual, retail, R&D position, and how that jives with the sort of lifestyle and tenor and ways that chefs work.
Well, I think there's several trends happening right now. I'm seeing companies that and concepts that want to essentially sort of make fresh food more democratic. So taking fine dining and sort of, I don't want to say trading down, but making more accessible for the masses. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, you know, the talents of a fine dining chef, while, you know, you saute sort of fresh kale, it turns out very differently when you are in a manufacturing process that gets translated into going on a truck from a central facility, taking a couple hours away, and distributing that. So this concept of sort of transportation and translating fresh food in a fine dining atmosphere, a la minute, into sort of the technical, scientific heat and hold, you know, all these kind of technical and scientific terms that come up don't always happen well. So there's like the separation between what I think happens in a test kitchen mm-hmm. to what happens on the floor. There is sort of some companies do it better than others, and some there's a question mark. Well, okay, and it tastes great in the kitchen, but we can't seem to manufacture it day in and day out, mm-hmm. and more importantly, get it transported and have it taste so fresh for the consumer. So, for example, like a lot of people want to have this fresh squeezed lemon, right? So you might want to squeeze it right in front of a customer, but when you squeeze it at the manufacturing facility 4 hours ago, by the time it gets to the consumer, it might have changed that whole flavor profile completely, and it might just taste terrible. Mm-hmm. So then how do you deal with that?
How much of dealing with that is scientific versus, say, a virtuoso kind of talent among the chefs and the folks working in the manufacturing plant?
I think there's like this very healthy tension right now that's happening. Mm-hmm. So I think that people want to elevate flavors and taste and fresh and make it delicious. I think I hear that over and over again. It's certainly not just...
What does that mean?
I know, right? Sort of just like, well, I want it to taste just like I would make it at home, sort of this fresh feel. Mm-hmm. And but unfortunately, there's sort of, you know, what there's this blockage is really around the logistics of sort of the ingredients coming in. And I hate to say when it's being received. So like today, on a snowy day like today, think about all the truckers coming in to deliver into Brooklyn, you know, certain corners. Aren't, you know, and everything gets backed up, so then your onions don't get chopped on time, then it's not as fresh, maybe your refrigerator breaks down because it's frozen or something, and all this kind of has a knock-on effect in the way, you know, you think about the number of steps it takes to develop that same recipe day in and day out. So part of the challenge is looking at the number of steps in the recipe uh-huh. and saying, well, how does this really impact the operation? So the heart and soul in a manufacturing facility. You know, how many steps is it going to take to go from a cooler box into, you know, rolling out the dough or putting it back in the refrigerator or putting this in the freezer and trucking it down to Tennessee?
For example,
right? So that's where, you know, really the rubber meets the road mm-hmm. in taking somebody's delicious quote-unquote recipe in the test kitchen and putting
right.
it out.
Because ultimately, at the end of the day, in this world, consistency is king.
Yes.
Right? So if we were to think about terms like consistency, deliciousness, fresh, healthy, and durable... I'm going to put you on the spot here. How would you rank them? At the end of the day, when it gets on the supermarket shelf or on the shelf at Organic Avenue or Pret-a-Manger or you know, any number of these places, and we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the folks you're working with and how they're dealing with these challenges, how would you rank the priority? Of things like that, and you can add other qualifiers.
I do think there's two issues at hand, which actually it's not about real. It is a little bit about the cost of these ingredients, mm-hmm. but more and more people are wondering, well, how much do I have to pay for consistency?
Uh-huh.
So there's that question. The second thing is really around...
At the operator level.
Yeah, other operator. Uh-huh. And the second thing is around supply risk. So it's not necessarily like, well, can I get organic watermelons for X price? But it's really around, can I get organic watermelon during the season when I want to put out this, let's say, juice or this fresh salad? And and that's a huge challenge because especially when it comes to produce, you know, it's like the weather. You don't know whether or not it's just suddenly not going to show up 1 week. So I think those two are some of the bigger issues today mm-hmm. that I see in sort of particularly in concepts that use a lot of fresh produce. And that's obviously a trend.
Right.
That's a huge trend right now.
And those kinds of companies are really comprising the bulk of your work right now.
Yes, and I think that it is, and I think that more and more we're just seeing a balance between, you know, sort of protein, traditional sort of meat center of the plate, and having produce play a bigger role, whether mm-hmm. or not that's sort of the raw vegan cleanse sort of bucket, or just folks just saying, you know what, I actually want my plate to look like it's 50% fresh fruits and vegetables and, yep, you know, some meat, but it's not going to be the center of plate as we traditionally have known.
Right. So that's another interesting kind of cultural trend that's happening in this quick service retail field. So I noticed that it's 11:15. I think we're going to take a little bit of a break, and this is a good moment to take a break. So I'm going to instigate the break. And then we'll come back in a minute or so and continue this conversation. Thank you. If you'd like to call in, the number is 718-497-2128. I misspoke before. Or you can tweet questions to @TasteMattersHRN.
You're listening to Sweet Talk by Pamela Royal on heritageradionetwork.org.
Heritage Foods USA is proud to announce our Heritage Rare Breed Chicken Rotation. We've partnered with Frank Reese, the country's preeminent poultry farmer, to create an alternative market for non-industry bred chicken and show our customers what real chicken tastes like. Frank's chickens look and taste different from commodity poultry. They have not been genetically manipulated or pumped with antibiotics to increase their growth rate. Frank breeds and hatches his own birds so he can guarantee the finest animal welfare from start to finish. Every 3 months, Heritage Foods USA will offer a new, rare breed of chicken on our website and at the Heritage Meat Shop. Our inaugural variety is the Colombian Wyandotte. These birds are good for frying and are sought after for their fine texture, taste, and healthy lipid fine yellow fat. Heritage Foods USA is the only place you can taste these special heritage birds. Order today at heritagefoodsusa.com.
Hello, and welcome back to the second half of Taste Matters. I am Karen Karp, filling in for Mitchell Davis today, and our guest is Monica Jalinas of Gritwork. We were just talking during the break about how we've only scratched the surface of this whole kind of conversation about putting great tasting food out to the masses in a you called it a democratic way. I'm thinking about food entering into trying to enter into a little bit of an egalitarian phase. And I think I want to kind of, before we go to the kind of trends and things that are happening in the marketplace, let's go back a moment. Let's roll it back a little bit to, for a few minutes, let's talk about what it's like to work with some of these suppliers, right? So here you are in New York City. Most of your clients are here in New York City. Some of these trends are born here or brought here and trying to become more national. Pret a Manger, which we talked about earlier, started in New York, then expanded to a number of other cities. Some of your other clients are doing that as well, and I would like you to give a shout out to them as it is relevant to the conversation. But let's talk about what happens when you go out with this idea that your client has said, I want to have organic XYZ year-round in these shops in New York City, and I want it to be at the X price point, and you go out and talk to suppliers. Tell us about how some of the suppliers react to the kinds of requests that you're making of them, and how you work to help turn these suppliers' interest towards working with some of these new companies.
Well, I think that's an excellent question. So that's why oftentimes I'm brought on. So what traditionally happens in fast casual or with brands is starts a lot with marketing. People say, oh, this looks great. Why don't we come out with a pomegranate smoothie? And then what the next step is, they go to the buyer and says, okay, go find, you know, organic pomegranates, and, you know, we're going to launch it 6 months from now. Just thinking that it's going to appear
magically
and that it's available all the time. There's no like, well, is that the right time for pomegranate? So what's happening is that sometimes the retail calendar doesn't coincide with local seasonal calendar on sort of the harvest supply side.
Right.
And some of my clients include like Blueprint Cleanse, Organic Avenue, Dig In, and all these clients are sort of in that produce world where you need to build a calendar 6 months in advance just because you need to, you know, print out logos or flyers and train your staff. That takes time. But yet you're trying to use sort of seasonal items and test them in time. So it's very difficult because it doesn't jive in a way, because you, like, for example, I'll give grapefruit. Yeah. So like during certain seasons, it's a thicker skin, and other seasons it's thinner skin. So how do you know when to test that item? Like, do you want to test it right then and there and then say, okay, we're going to just put this out to market next week, which is not mechanically possible from a business perspective, right? You need that window where you tell your team, this is, you know, train your staff on how to make it and how to produce it and change all the labels. And it takes months. And then, you know, have you just lost your window of seasonality?
Right. Give us another example from one of those three clients, for example, of a product that they were really, really anxious, desperate to put on their menu, and just how complications unraveled that idea, and did it work or not work?
Well, I mean, I'll take the hyper seasonal items, like, for example, asparagus, or certainly organic watermelon. Organic watermelon juice, it sounds really good from a consumer perspective, but it has a very small window of opportunity.
Like, so, how long?
Maybe like 2-3 months. So again, like, it's like, do you want to expend all that energy to put out something where you have to think to yourself, is this going to be a number one bestseller from a marketing perspective, that we're going to go to all this trouble and say that it is seasonal? Or do you say, you know, Monica, as a buyer, can you help us look for maybe frozen organic watermelon juice on the shoulder seasons, that maybe we can then sell this 12 months out of the year? So you have to think, if you can't get fresh, are there sort of these other sort of manufactured products that will quote unquote lengthen the shelf life? So there's a huge trend right now around HPP, which is sort of lengthening shelf life of particularly produce items and also meats too, but it's keeping it very fresh. The flavor still holds very high. I mean, there's a lot of questions around that, but then it's like, okay, so as the integrity that comes forth is that, do as consumers, do we expect menu items for how long during the year, right?
So HPP, what does that stand for? Our listeners are dying to know.
High pressurized pasteurization, okay. Which is basically washed at very high cold temperature, cold, and so it's not killing sort of the usual process of pasteurization.
So it's so a cold pasteurization?
Yes,
That's interesting.
Yes. So
does it work with a chemical or?
No, it's just washed. And I haven't seen the process, but it's basically, to me, I've heard it's like, it looks like it's going down a submarine. It came from sort of like submarine technology and just gets washed, like,
that's incredible,
by thousands and thousands of pressure points.
And how does that affect the flavor of, give us an example.
For example, lemon juice. Mm-hmm. It keeps it really fresh. I mean, so instead of saying, you know, think about hand squeezing a lemon. You can do one pretty well, but let's say you had to peel and squeeze 165 in a case average. Mm-hmm. And let's say you had to squeeze 100 cases to make an ingredient within. Right. So why not buy a processed, a high quality, lemon juice that's got the same integrity, right? So there is a lot of technology in play in order to keep fresh as good, but in sort of this sort of fresh manufactured capability.
Right. Interesting.
So I think people think, well, like, do people just, you know, sit around here and squeezing things? Yeah, absolutely. There is that. But the evolution of that is as item, and this is where I have attention around, you know, how big do you want to be? It's like, well, as you squeeze more lemons, you know, do we add more employees in the back, or do we look to technology or certain shortcuts to make this better for, easier for us?
Talk to us a little bit about technology. What have you seen evolve in the last 15 years? What wasn't available in 1999 that is available today?
I think that just this whole idea around holding fresh and frozen, like, as the integrity has really changed, I think there's just a lot more sort of electronic elements to it. So, I don't know. I can't speak to that as well as.
But you see more. I mean, this HPP process, for example, is relatively new.
Yes,
didn't exist 15 years ago.
I think it actually came from the protein world.
Interesting.
There is,
sure.
So it came from that.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting. Let's switch gears a little bit. I mean, I could, of course, talk about fruits and vegetables all day, and I'm remembering some of the conversations that we've had with upstate farmers about, like, plugging into the, you know, New York City quick serve kind of world. But I don't want this moment of having you on this show to go without talking about flour.
Yes.
Interesting, right? Going back to Pret and some of the projects since Pret, flour specification, this might be something that our listeners don't know a whole lot about. But talk to us about how what's important with flour and what are some of the... Just tell us a flour story.
Well,
I don't mean chrysanthemums.
Yeah, no, you know, a lot of us think just certain ingredients just sort of appear. And flour, to me, growing up, was sort of one of these ingredients where you buy all-purpose flour and, like, you know, a pound
bag or
something.
Make a go of it.
Yes, but actually, I mean, there's a growing season, right? So it's, you know, from the Midwest or wherever it's from, there's characteristics largely around sort of, like, the ash level, the protein level, mm-hmm. and, you know, all sorts of things that then make up the composition of a baked good or mm-hmm. or a noodle or mm-hmm. something like that. And one of the things that's very interesting that was a takeaway from commodities expert that we worked with, Bob Resnahan, said, you know, there's this rise in obviously using sort of like these whole wheat flours or whole grain flours, but in actuality, you know, how does that change production? So maybe you need to actually add more gluten, for example, mm-hmm. to hold the pieces together, mm-hmm. that sink. Mm-hmm. And all these things that's come into play where you're like, wow, does that then affect, you know, certain allergens? I don't know. I mean, I don't know what's out there. So in that formulation, the back end is like as basic as flour is that, you know, the color that you want. So for instance, if you want a white flour to make, you know, white bread, it has to be as white as it could be. You're sort of extracting more and more of the bran out and at least the byproduct. And the byproduct, I mean, I didn't know this, but it's sold into feed and all sorts of things. And it's sort of like a Tetris, you know, puzzle where you're putting together, well, who will then take the byproduct? Can a pita manufacturer making whole wheat purchase that? Or can you know, can it be sold into protein? So there's sort of this waste management, but it's not waste management, right? About sort of managing flour and those expectations.
Right. It's sort of like a life cycle approach to product sourcing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which gets more and more interesting as you start to think about all the different alternative energy sources and the exchange of spent grain, for example, to pig farms and such like that. I actually do have an ulterior motive about asking you about flour, which is the following. And it kind of is a way to also bring in, which we haven't really talked about, is the whole local food trend. But I do want your professional opinion about the potential for more grain, particularly flour, to be not only coming into New York City from the region, and I mean the Northeast region, and including sort of Southern Canada, et cetera, and actually being milled here. I know we asked you this question a couple months ago because of a project that we're working on, and I just wonder what New York City might look like if more flour was actually being milled here and distributed to some of the artisan bakeries. What is that like a complete dream in my head, or is it possible?
You know, I don't know the technicalities around running a flour mill. I mean, I've toured several, but I do think that as sort of consumer brands I've worked with, they would love to sort of get access to regional grains, unique different grains, whether, you know, right now it's frika, wheat berries, and all sorts of different things. People are, you know, quinoa is at an all-time supply risk right now, believe it or not. There's, like, no more, and the costs are out through the roof.
Oh, my God, there's going to be a crisis in the
like
kitchen at Carp Resources.
There is, like, this quinoa crisis going on right now. So absolutely do I think there should be sort of other types of grains coming on the marketplace. And I think the challenge is going back to the sort of the pieces. So, like, if we mill all this type of grain, well, where does that excess go? And that sort of thing. I think there's got to be this matchmaking component. Yeah. And that's why I talked about, should there be some type of co-op where, you know, companies come together and say, I want this, I want that. And then it kind of goes back into the supply side.
Right. Do you think that, like, for example, the manufacturers that you're working with, I know you're working with a lot of folks that are buying a lot of fruits and veg, but could you imagine if there was a sort of like a higher flavor profile value proposition to buying in a cooperative way. Can you imagine some of these companies working together in that way?
I do. I think that there's more and more of that happening. And I think there's the whole movement towards sort of quote-unquote transparency and sort of realness. And at the end of the day, like all the players are pretty, you know, I mean, we all know one another, right? There's a healthy sort of relationship there. Yeah. But also, you know, at arm's length as well, you know?
Yeah.
So, yes, I do think that
transparency that to a degree,
right?
no sharing of recipes. So, one final question for you, because I see our half hour is almost up. It's shocking. What advice do you have for chefs if chefs are being approached by companies to come on board and be their head of R&D or their head chef or their executive chef or whatever? Give some advice to chefs who are really some significant listeners of this show. What advice do you have for them?
I would say two things. One is that don't look at some of the recipes that come out sort of dumbing down or sort of like feeling like you're giving over to this heightened level of what's the most delicious and most amazing meal, right? Uh-huh. So you have to think about it as a lot of the companies want to sell this for an affordable price.
Right.
So, and I think it's to back into that. Well, then what do I have to play with? Uh-huh. And not feel like it's a less than.
Yeah.
And then the second thing is that I think a lot of chefs could work more collaboratively. For example, like if you're thinking about an ingredient, you know, pull in whether it's the buyer or the marketer, and it's not that, you know, there's this chef in the corner with the white coat and the hat. And I think that's really important from a sort of making the business case. So as you come to the table of like, this is the recipe, you got to have food cost on, you got to have thought about the elements around seasonality, how long can I get this for, and can we put this out for this price.
And
I know that sounds very basic, but
but it's also using the talents of the team around you.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Great. Well, I see we are out of time. I want to thank you, Monica Jalinas of Gritwork. I also want to thank Mitchell Davis for giving me the opportunity to fill in for him today, and Ashley Koziak, our delightful producer of the show, wearing big, fat snow boots today. And this is Karen Karp wishing you a good day. Stay warm, stay dry, and eat good food.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.